accession number 20146, reel 1.
Roy Tomlin, reel 1. Where were you born, please?
St Thomas's Hospital, London.
Which year was this?
1923.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in London?
No, not in actual fact. I used to live in Wandsworth Road with my father's parents until I was about 5. And then we moved to Beckentry or Dagenham. My father was a police sergeant in the railway police, and he was allocated a house on the what was then the new Beckentry council estate. So I'd done all my schooling in Dagenham and Hornchurch.
How old were you when you left school?
14.
So that would have been in 37?
37.
Did you get a job?
Yes, straight away.
Doing what?
I worked as a messenger boy on the London North Eastern Railway at King's Cross.
Is that what you were doing when war was declared?
Yes, and I was called up from there too.
Had you joined TA before the war?
Not the TA, I belonged to the Home Guard.
Can you tell me about joining the Home Guard and what you did?
Yes, I belonged to the Romford, what they called the Romford District, and we were stationed in the waiting rooms at Romford Station. And we used to patrol the railway lines at night between Romford Station and the next one up, Chapel Heath, backwards and forwards, and we used to take it in shifts, backwards and forwards. And that's what we were employed to do, or we were supposed to do. And I was there with them until I was called up in 1942.
Did you have any experiences with the Home Guard?
No, no.
How much training did you get with them?
Very little, actually. We used to go out on a Sunday morning with sticks and what have you, and they used to take us out to what was then the old country park at Harrow Wood and those places, and we'd stick bits of grass in our helmet and all that sort of thing. We played at being soldiers, really.
What kind of men were in your local unit?
Anything from my age at that time. Two elderly men. We had a former mayor of Dagenham with us. The whole spectrum, right through to people of his age, this mayor, and he must have been 60 at that time.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Yes.
Under what circumstances?
I was down at Luton at the time, at my mother's parents' house, and we listened to the radio and heard it declared. Yes.
How did you feel about that?
Well, as a young lad of 18, it didn't really bother me too much. There was too much excitement, well, at least what I class as excitement.
And were you in any bombing of England before you joined up?
Yes, I used to bomb because we lived in Hornchurch, just across here actually. And they used to bomb parts of Hornchurch and Romford. In Sendries mainly, we had a big open area between us and the river. And whether these incendiaries were meant for the river or whatever, we don't know. But there was a lot of incendiary bombs dropped here.
But no high explosive?
One or two high explosive. We lost one or two houses within the district. Yes, we did.
Where did they fall?
In Romford mainly, yes. I can't remember seeing anything in the immediate Hornchurch area.
What was your address at that time?
Chestnut Avenue, Hornchurch, which is about a mile from where we are now.
Did you get any incendiaries where you were?
No, but I was in the local, what they call them, not local defence. We were in the local people that used to go out with the fire guards and all that, and we used to with our stirrup pumps and try and put them out. Saw plenty, but they didn't bother us too much.
Were they called air raid wardens?
Air raid wardens, that's right. Yes, they were. Yes.
Did you feel the Germans would invade at that time?
No, I didn't know too much about it that time. No, and I think everybody was the same. We had a fear at the back of our mind that we could lose the war and they could invade, I suppose, but it didn't really, it wasn't uppermost in our mind.
Did you ever listen to Churchill on the radio?
Yes.
What effects did his speeches have?
Well, I think the effect was what they were meant to have. It was to bolster you up. He couldn't do any more than anybody else could do, but I think the way he did it bolstered you up. Yes.
And Lord Haw-Haw?
Yes, we used to listen to him sometimes, or with ridicule, but then with hindsight, it wasn't necessarily ridicule.
How do you mean?
Well, he used to say things and we would laugh at it. And within a few days, you'd find out it was true. We lost a capital ship at one time, and he said that it had been sunk. And everybody in the room laughed and said, you know, what fun. But it turned out, I forget the name of the ship, but it turned out that it was true. That we had lost this capital ship, yes.
Now, can you tell me about joining up, please?
Yes, I was called up on the 2nd of July, 1942. And I had to report to the barracks at Newport on the Isle of Wight, an infantry training regiment.
What happened to you there?
Well, you were there for 6 weeks, and while you were there, the idea was that they sorted out and put square pegs in round in square holes, but you were given all sorts of tests, applications to see what they thought you were good for, and I was lucky enough, I think, to be picked for an armoured regiment.
What did you think of the training that you were receiving on the Isle of Wight?
Well, it's very good. It was basic military training, but very, very good, yes. You went in boys and came out men, I think, even after 6 weeks.
How did they manage to do that?
I don't know. It wasn't fear, and nothing like the television portrays now. I can't remember my sergeant major ever swearing at me like they do now. And it wasn't necessary. I think we knew we were there for a purpose. And that was that.
Were you able to cope with it yourself?
Yes.
What was the next step for you?
After 3 months, they decided I was going to this armoured regiment. And they sent me to an armoured training unit at Cove in Hampshire. You possibly know that. Right next door to the airport, aerodrome, whatever they call it, the experimental place there. And there I was introduced to all sorts of tanks. We had driving lessons, radio lessons, gunnery lessons, and they sorted out what you were going to do.
What aspects of the work did you prefer?
I preferred the driving, but I think there was far too many drivers for far too few tanks. So I had to take second best, and I ended up as a radio-operated gunner in the tank. And after 3 months of training down at Cove, we used to go out all over Wokingham and all around those places, you know, with the radios in little trucks, I was sent to the 24th Lancers, who at that time were up in Chippenham, which was just outside Cambridge. And I was sent to A Squadron, and there I stayed.
What kind of reception did you get from the unit when you got to Chippenham?
Very good. They were looking at that time, or waiting for all sorts of, not replacements, because they hadn't been anywhere, bringing the regiment up to total scratch. And obviously they had their ways of doing things as opposed to possibly a training regiment. But you soon fell in with their ways. I mean, I had my own tank commander, who was a lieutenant. Your own squadron commander, the major, and you got to know them quite well. There was none of this. They would talk down to you. They were very, very good. I thought they were very good.
What kind of equipment did they have?
Well, at the time I joined the 24th Lancers, we had Centurion tanks, which were English or British tanks. Very low, very squat, very fast. but a little pea shooter of a gun. And the story went round that eventually we were going to get issued with American Shermans. Nothing happened for, well, perhaps 12 months or more. And then suddenly we had to take or send all the British tanks away, and they in came the American Shermans. None of us liked them. They were far too top-heavy. They had a reputation of being what the lads called Tommy Cookers. They would brew up or blow up or anything at the least provocation. And they were rather sluggish. And there again, I went through all the things I'd been through before, driver training, gunnery training, radio training. But as I say, you did it their way. And eventually you came out what I like to consider to be a qualified tank soldier.
What were the British tanks you had before the Sherman?
Covenanters and Crusaders.
And did you prefer them to the Sherman?
I did, yes. But again, with hindsight, when you went into action with a Covenanter, which had a paper-thin skin and a pop gun for a gun, possibly the Shermans were better equipped. But I think you got that impression because you probably know that during the whole of the Northwest Europe campaign, the main British battle tank was the Sherman. And there were so many of them that you couldn't get away from them wherever. You went to one or two specialist regiments, like the Guards Armoured Division. They had Churchills and all that sort of thing. So you really didn't see what they could do. You only knew what you could do in your Sherman.
Any experiences you had in Cambridgeshire at this time?
No, not really, no. We used to go out on schemes. You'd be away for a week or be away for a few days. You used to get leave regularly. Every couple of months you had leave, which was no problem for me. We used to hitchhike down the main road to Romford. No problem. Life was quite good at that time. But as I say, we weren't in the thick of it then.
Did you have any inkling as to what was coming?
Yes. We knew that we were being trained to be what they called at that time was an armoured... Oh, dear. It was an armoured regiment for reconnaissance and another word for piercing. You would go out. That was the idea, that they wanted this. They were making up. They took us out of the... at that time, if I can just digress there, we went from Cambridge to Bridlington in Yorkshire. Took our tanks with us. And we used to have all our tanks lined up along the seafront. And we used to live in the hotels. Very Spartan, of course, but we lived in the hotels along the front. And people used to come on holiday to Bridlington. Public. We used to have what they call War Weapons Weeks, and you would take all the young ladies over your tank and show them in. And it was the life of Riley, in actual fact. You can't get away from that. At that time, it was the life of Riley.
And then what?
Well, then we knew, we were told that we were going to be used for this armoured, as this armoured regiment for forward use in an invasion. And then everything from that time on was told was invasion motivated. We sealed the tanks. They used a sealant very much like plasticine, and we used to seal up all the joints and the holes and everything in the hull. And they would take us to different places, and we would run our tank through like a ford, to see if any water came in. You had ducts on the back, big metal ducts, and you would seal those in with this plasticine, run a wire around, and the wire would be plugged into the driver's dashboard, what would now be the equivalent of the cigar lighter. And when you got out the other end of the Ford, you plug it in, switch the switch, and it would just go bang, and all the plasticine would blow off, and the ducts would fall off. The idea being, of course, when you landed in Normandy, that you were going to be in some sort of water. But that worked, no problem. And then from then on, when we'd done all that sort of training, and I think we were as far trained as we could be, we knew exactly what we were going to do and how we were going to do it. And then they sent us down to just off Bournemouth, opposite the Isle of Wight. And they put us in what was at one time a sanatorium, right on the beach. And we were there for about 2 months before D-Day. And all that time we were spent in earnest sealing the tanks, cleaning them, cleaning the guns, everything. We knew exactly what was going to happen then. From then on, they took us to, or sent us to, Hursley Park, which is a great big park just outside Winchester. And we were sealed inside this concentration area. No one was allowed in, no one was allowed out. And we had big marquees with big maps, dioramas, I think they called them, on the tables. We had a very accurate map of the place we were going to land, and they pinpointed two spots either end of your landing sector. And as I say, when we got there, they were there. We knew exactly what it was. We saw this early in the morning on D-Day. The sanatorium and this big hospital that was there, and a big gun emplacement that was there, and we could see them through the binoculars from out at sea. So we knew exactly where we were and what we were going to do. And that was that. And in the afternoon of D-Day, we landed.
Can you tell me about the crossing, please? What that was like for you?
Didn't have very much effect on me personally, except we were shifted from an LCT, LST rather, the landing ship, and we were shifted onto, you probably know the Rhino ferry, obviously, and we were shifted onto a Rhino ferry out at sea. The American captain of the LST refused to take us in any further, and they brought the Rhino ferry round to the front, hooked on, and we shifted the tanks from the Rhino, from the landing ship, onto the Rhino ferry. And that was hairy. You had to wait until the man on the Rhino ferry saw the two bits come down like this, and when he did, he lowered his arm and you revved up and went like mad across the gap. And having got onto the Rhino ferry, it was night or evening, and they wanted us to get inside the tanks for fear of shrapnel, bombing, anything. I, for one, refused to get inside. I wouldn't get inside. If I'm going to sit inside there and this Rhino ferry slides, tips, we're going to slide off the edge and I'm going to be inside. So very few of us got inside, but that was the only hairy part. And then, of course, the landing, which was noisy, frightening. I say frightening, but, again, you have to remember that we were 19, it was excitement. I mean, we were watching the Germans through the binoculars. It didn't really do a lot to us. It was exciting. You didn't realise at that time that very soon you'd be there, and that would be part of you. And it wasn't until we actually landed on the beach that we saw lads that had gone before us being killed, and they were lined up on the sand, and they had their gas capes and all sorts of tarpaulins thrown over them. You could see by the boots in the coming out the end that they were British soldiers, you know. Then you started to realise what it was all about, and they weren't playing games. And then you got frightened.
Were you under much incoming fire?
Yes, yes. We landed at a small place called Le Hamel, which is just along the coast from Arromanches. And it was one of the last places to be taken on D-Day because the infantry had a heck of a job to clear them out. And there was a lot of heavy fire concentrated on that area. So, of course, we were getting it as we were coming in. Lots of heavy fire. We lost a lot of vehicles, lost a lot of men, actually, there. But eventually we got ashore and moved in. And the next thing I remember, of course, was rendezvousing in an orchard and we were safely ashore, still being fired at, and you could hear the stuff coming through the air, actually, you know. But at least we was in the orchard and on dry land.
Were you conscious of any hits on your tank?
No, not at that time, no.
And did the waterproofing work all right?
Yes, yes. Yes, we had no water inside, apart from here and there you'd slop about a bit of water, which is to be expected, but it didn't sort of leak in, didn't pour in or anything like that, no.
Had you landed in deep water?
Not deep water, I would say 3-4 foot of water. We didn't, the tank was not submersed in water, as some of them were.
And which tank were you in?
Sherman.
Did it have a name?
Yes, funnily enough, I was me that painted the name on the side. Being A Squadron, we had to have a name if you wanted a name that began with A. So it was apostrophe Appy, Hampstead. And I had nothing to do, so I painted it on the front.
Appy Hampstead?
Appy Hampstead, no H's.
Why did it have that name?
Don't know, I must have heard it, being coming from London, I must have heard of Appy Hampstead, where they had the fairgrounds and all that.
And who else was in the tank with you?
Four others. A driver, co-driver, commander, wireless operator, gunner. Five crew.
And what ranks were there?
All troopers except the tank commander. Oh no, the tank commander was a lieutenant. Lieutenant Barry. He was a tank commander. All the others were troopers. Yes.
Where did Lieutenant Barry come from?
Hertfordshire, Tring.
So you then reached an orchard, you said?
Yes, and we stayed in that orchard overnight. All you can really remember about those times is that you had an early rising, you had to stand to very early in the morning, about 4 o'clock in the morning, and you had to stand to until daylight. That didn't present a lot of problems. Plenty of firing, plenty of noise, and what have you. But we never saw anybody try to get into the orchard, come close to the orchard. No Germans ever came close to the orchard that we were in. And then you went out the next day and you had to advance.
What was that like?
Frightening. A tank soldier has a very restricted view of a battle. All you're looking through is that. Because you're enclosed. You have your periscope and you have a very restricted view. If you're driving along straight, you don't know who is on that side of you or who is on that side of you. All you can see is who's there. So suddenly you hear all sorts of bangs and noises and explosions and you don't know where they are or what they are. The only way we were told that if you see black smoke, it's probably from German fire, which turned out to be true. And this sort of thing, we were brought up in the middle of the night to fight battles. The Germans tried to infiltrate us one night, and we had to get up, get into the tanks and repel them. All that sort of went on for about a week, which was very, very hairy, very, very frightening. I was frightened anyway. I think at that stage you got over the excitement bit and you realised what it was all about. We were then making towards a village called Tilly-sur-Sels. And we knew, or we'd been told, that the Germans were in this village and they had fortified it. And in actual fact, 23 battles went on for Tilly, backwards and forwards. We took it, the Germans retook it, and vice versa. And 23 times this happened. And we went in one morning, very early, very early. We were sent out as A Squadron, we were sent out to reconnoitre the fronts. And we were going along quite fast for what we could do. 30 mile an hour was quite fast in a Sherman, you know. And we thought we were doing quite well. And suddenly this hell of an explosion happened and we'd been hit by an 88 shell. I don't know whether it was an 88 gun or whether it was a tank with an 88 gun on it. We don't know. But we were blown up. The tank caught fire. The driver jumped out the front of the tank. He jumped into a trench that was full of Germans. We could hear them shouting, and we could hear the machine guns going, and then it all went quiet. And I was inside with the tank still blazing, and they couldn't get me out until the tank commander, Lieutenant Barry, leaned in through the top of the tank turret, and he got me by the webbing, and he pulled me up through the turret. He pulled me to the top of the turret, and then he fell off, and I was left up there. Well, the Germans must have seen this because they fired at me with a machine gun. And the bullets, in actual fact, hit my back and they ricocheted off my back. And the force of that ricochet knocked me from the top of the turret to the ground. When this shell came through, it hit me in the side here. I have no backside here at all. It took that away. So, of course, on the right-hand side. And, of course, I lost blood. When the machine gun bullets knocked me onto the ground, I laid there, and I laid there for hours, and I could hear all this battle going on around. I could hear the Germans shouting. They sent out a couple of our Bren gun carriers, and they were forced back. We could hear the German infantry. We could hear the German tanks, actually. We knew they were German tanks because of which side they were. And eventually I fainted, and I must have been out for some long, long time through loss of blood. This is all well documented, by the way. I must have been out a long, long time. And eventually, we used to carry what they called 4x2. We used to clean the guns, your revolvers and that, with it, a piece of cotton wool. I had a piece of that in my pocket, and I laid underneath this tree, and I took this 4x2, tied it onto a twig, and I was doing this. I didn't know, but a fella called Harry Jews, he's in that list. He was a sergeant, tank sergeant. He saw this waving, and he asked for permission to come out and get me. Well, at that time, it was too rough for anybody to come out, but eventually, when the Germans had been forced back, and they'd come up to somewhere near, our drone troops had come up somewhere to near where we were, he came and he got me. And he picked me up, and he arranged for the Devons and the Dorset Regiment to send out one of their stretcher jeeps, and they put me on a stretcher, took me back to the coast. And every year at my reunion, Harry and I have a drink. Because without him, I don't think I would be here.
And you said these machine gun bullets were hitting you without penetrating?
Yes, and I had the marks on my back now, yes.
Was that because they were at long range or something?
No, not particularly. I was going to say bad marksmanship, but I don't think it's even that. It's one of those things, they fire at you. And instead of the bullets going into you, they were just a little bit high, and they were ricocheting off my back. But the force of that was enough to roll me off this turret onto the ground. I remember screaming. Lieutenant Barry, when I got knocked on the ground, he was there. He was down there. And we laid together and he was quiet. He was telling me the Germans were in the slit trench. So we laid there. And he had a letter in an envelope in his pocket. So he took this letter out and he laid on his back. And I can see him doing it now. He's on his back and he's got a pencil. Stay where you are. I'm going to get help. Don't know what he thought he was going to do or where he was going. And he was gone. And that's when I think that Harry Jews asked for permission to come out and pick me up. Now, that letter done the rounds until Lieutenant Barry died about 4 or 5 years ago. And up until then, he used to bring this letter to every reunion we had. He would show it around. You know, it was something in those days. You know, he would show. I don't know what became of the letter. I don't know whether his wife's got it or anything like that, but that's what happened after that day. And from then on, I was put onto a hospital ship and brought back to England.
Were you in much pain?
Yes, yes. Yeah. I'd lost the whole of the sciatic muscle down